as long as I've been doing computers, the concept of, and going back to like the early, I guess, 1980-ish or something like that, on TRS-80, my first commercial computer was a TRS-80. I'd kind of try to hack together some stuff from parts or whatever, and really, there's just was, you know, getting like something with a display and everything was a big deal back then. And so, from the earliest thing, graphics and visualization of data and the Earth and space and stuff like that was really kind of an interest of mine. I had gotten one of these little department store telescopes from my aunt for Christmas one year, and loved looking at stuff through the light-polluted L.A. skies. And, you know, pretty much it was like planets and the moon was about the only thing you could really see.
So you're in the same boat as Curtis, actually, trying to, you know, work your way through the ambient light of Los Angeles.
Yeah, but in that environment, right, but I still was really passionate about that whole concept and really kind of, some reoccurring themes were, you know, like exploring the Mandelbrot set. You know, if every time computers got a little bit more powerful, I would look at looking at the Earth, looking at the stars, and looking at the Mandelbrot set as like some, you know, litmus test of how fast, or how much computers changed. And so continually through my career, through several iterations, I've always, you know, come back to some of these themes. Later on, about 2000, 2001 time frame, I became involved. I was the development manager for Microsoft Home Advisor, and we were assimilating this property called TerraServer, which was a research project looking for a home as part of a consumer project. And Tom Barkley, a researcher from Bay Area and working with Jim Gray, said, hey, you know, USGS has this DEM, digital elevation model data, that they'd like me to load into TerraServer, and I'm wondering if you have any ideas of what we could do with it. And I'd been playing, I'd been very much into 3D visualization, and I have this program called Lightwave, which was an animation and rendering program. Used on things like, you know, Serenity and Battlestar Galactica and stuff like that, you know, nowadays, and it goes back a long time. Mm-hmm. But I started taking TerraServer images and taking the digital elevation models from USGS and creating little chunks of hills with the texture mapped images. And then I started researching some stuff, and Tom Barkley told me about this set that NASA was doing, where they basically were using this satellite weather data and essentially watching it over a period of many days and getting rid of all the clouds so that you could see mm-hmm. the surface of the Earth in mass. Mm-hmm. And they called it the Blue Marble Project. And So I went and found and downloaded that data, and then I also downloaded some global data for digital elevation models on a global basis, and started working to create a 3D, a hierarchical 3D view of the Earth, and that you could basically see the mountains sticking off, and you know, the mountains and the oceans and the, you know, land mass, et cetera, and then, you know, zoom in and move your mouse around to browse it, and then work to see how to bring that into the, you know, TerraServer tiles to be able to get the TerraServer rendering, because we had all the way down to, like, a couple of meters. And so this was, I saw a lot of possibility in this, and as we started trying to talk to some people about what it would further require to develop something like this, there just didn't seem to be any interest in taking the mapping direction in that way. Hmm. And this was kind of you know, while I was inspired by Tom's project, it was something I was doing that had nothing to do with Home Advisor and was just kind of a private, a side project that really wasn't part of my core goals and objectives for my current job. And so I decided if there were no interest to develop at work, that I would try to see what I could do about visualizing other astronomy data and, using it as kind of a pet astronomy project. And so,
this was about when and kind of in terms
of... 2001, I think, was okay. when it got this far.
Okay. And, so this was kind of coinciding with, because I think it was 2002 that Jim Gray and Alex Zale published the paper that actually had the title
Worldwide Telescope.
Yeah. And so he was at that point that you were doing this, he was starting to get deeply into this astronomy data himself, right?
Right. So they, Alex was already had already been working on in fact, some of the stuff I think I remember talking or hearing Jim talk and about, Terra Server pointing up was the next thing that they were working on, and he was already, getting himself embedded with astronomers and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And I didn't see a lot of that.
Mm-hmm.
Tom was pretty much babysitting Terra Server while Jim was going off into the astronomy end of things. And so I was dealing more of the geo. But so I hadn't yet connected up with Jim regarding my astronomy passion.
Mm-hmm.
I think he might have been aware that I existed in some form or another, because I was working with the Terra Server side of things, and but we weren't collaborating on the astronomy part of it. And I was applying things to like the Moon, Mars, stuff that we had satellite radar altimetry and imagery of, and basically most of that was not put together and was not in a tiled multi-resolution view, so that it really wasn't browsable.
Okay.
It was just kind of mass raw data. So after having played around and made some demos, a lot of people thought it was cool, but basically no one who thought, there's like, it was just kind of cool technology, and no one really thought this is something you could monetize.
Mm-hmm.
So I kind of kept that on the back burner, and I moved out of Home Advisor, and I moved into some other groups. And during about that same time, I was building my observatory and basically working as an amateur astronomer. I decided I really needed kind of to invest in, Seattle, you take pictures when you can.
I was going to say, it's a tough road to hoe in Seattle.
If you can't push a button and have your observatory open up an image when you get some clear time,
the
amount of time it takes to set up everything, and then you could be clouded in by the time you're done setting up.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I really wanted something that when it got, when the opportunity hit, that you could do something with it. But it really... getting into automating it all and automating targeting and working with everything that was required to get the whole observatory done and do all the image processing, using catalogs to do plate solutions and to do planning and using, software for planning, automating the imaging run, processing the imaging, doing the analytical work with it afterwards, just really introduced me to the whole concept of what's required to do data collection, processing, and then research after it. And while I'm not a PhD astronomer by any means, this is, amateur, I do it for the love of it, I pretty much had to drill into the same world of the data and image processing that the professional astronomies had to deal with. I was using the same resources and stuff.
And this is exactly what I want to kind of get from you, because, essentially all of us are in the same boat, except not even as accomplished amateur astronomers as you are. But, we're sort of all aware that there are these data sets out there, but it's really kind of a mystery to us, like what are their characteristics and what's really involved in pulling that stuff together and weaving something like you've woven.
Well, part of this is, as I was discovering all of this, having to learn about it, I realized that there's a lot of stuff available, and that most of the people who are even amateur astronomers had no idea this stuff existed.
Mm-hmm.
They had no access to it. It was very difficult to get to. Even the scientists who were doing work with this stuff had a lot of difficulty getting to it.
I'm going to guess that
all of this is locked up in all these silos.
Yeah, I'm going to guess it's like basically, oh, if you know, you can go over here and you can get this gazipped tarball, and then if you unzip the thing and can kind of figure out, because there's really no documentation or explanation of metadata relationships
right. And
so on, right? Yeah, yeah.
So one of the things I realized is that, okay, so I'm an amateur astronomer, right? And I realized that I had heard that there was this very large database, the largest database of stellar objects created outside maybe the Vulcan Star Catalog. I'm just joking, but the U.S. Naval Observatory had prepared, and it was called USNOB, and it was 100 gigabytes. And at that time, 100 gigabytes was they were barely getting, consumer hard drives that were big enough to hold that, right?
Mm-hmm.
That was a pretty expensive drive.
Mm-hmm.
And so at that point, and that was a huge data. Forget ever trying to transmit that over the network. And on CDs, you're talking about 120 CDs or something like that. There's really not economical to do that. So the only way to transfer that amount of data was to ship a hard drive across the country.
I remember Jim talking about exactly doing that, yeah.
And so I'm just an amateur, but I kind of feel like I need to get access to the data, and there was no real way to get the bits and pieces I needed over the web. So I found out that this guy named Dave Monet, who is an astronomer at the U.S. Naval Observatory Flagstaff Station, that if I shipped him a hard drive, I finally got a hold of him, called him up, he basically said, ship me a hard drive, and I'll give you a Unix formatted partition with his data on there. And so I sent it to him, and I copied it, and I'm like, most people who run Windows can't even, so I'm looking at this, and I'm basically realizing that, okay, I'm managing to get a hold of some of this stuff, but this is staggeringly hard. And so while there is theoretically, I was shocked and surprised how easy it was for me to get at the same data that these professional astronomers are getting. Easy as in that it was actually possible at all.
Yeah, like you could
right?
get it.
That I could ship a drive to him, and he would actually copy it, and I wouldn't like have to pay him or get a government grant or some approval or something. But at the other time, I realized you got to be really committed, and you got to know exactly what you're doing to get any of this stuff.
Yep, there's no services wrapped around the data that make it at all tractable by anyone other than an incredibly dedicated, 100% focused researcher.
And essentially, I started realizing that the reason this guy wasn't bothered. He could copy this work for me is because he's sitting on top of this data that he spent years of his life to process, and basically no one can use it. And so anyone who's interested in spending the time to send him a drive, he's thinking, wow, this is worth copying it for him, right? It's not like he's so busy copying every day that he has to cut it down to only the people who really need it, right? So at the same time, I'm realizing if just little old me, who is not a university or whatever, I don't even have a PhD in astronomy, how do I deserve getting this data? So at one time, it's like I'm shocked how easy it is, to get permission to have the data, and that people want you to have the data, but I'm also shocked at how hard it is and inaccessible. And so I started doing something myself, which is I asked permission to take some of this data and put it on these portable USB hard drives in Windows formats and do a little bit of processing on it and basically make like a chain mail where people would email me saying that they wanted it, and each person would ship the portable drives to the next person on the list, copy it, and then ship it, et cetera, so that people could start getting access to it. But I realized, so now I get a couple of dozen people some astronomy data. That's just not enough.
Mm-hmm.
So as time went by, and I started doing more with imaging. I had this concept that I should flip my Earth inside out and start doing this, the whole, do the sky, rendered the sky. And so I was trying to get a hold of data, and one of my friends, a guy named Doug George, created a full sky survey from northern and southern hemisphere in full color, beautiful, gorgeous mosaic. But the software that went around with it would take like 10 to 15 seconds every time you just wanted to move your view around a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And it would take several seconds to update the screen. So nothing resembling interactive or real time.
Mm-hmm.
And here I had this application that essentially dealt with the same quality and quantity of data, but it was like instantaneous and fast in real time.
Mm-hmm.
And so I told him, I said, hey, you know, I could build an engine to go with your data and, figure out how to, visualize that data. And then I told him that, well, there was even a company called Starry Night Pro who was using some 3D effects but wasn't actually using, image data for the sky. He ended up going, so they were both Canadians, he actually went and talked to them and licensed his data to them. But the result that they had was something closed, not networked, and still very slow, not the same sort of interactivity. It was better, but still kind of. $400.
When did the version of Starry Night with the image data show up?
That was Pro Plus, and I think that was like, that's been like 3.5-4 years
okay.
at least, or something.
And what kind of imagery was in it?
What was in there was a now kind of a low to medium resolution full sky survey.
Uh-huh.
Of north and southern hemisphere done with Peter Cerviello and Doug George.
Okay.
So
when you say low to medium res, I mean, what could you see if you zoomed in on the galaxy?
Okay,
for example?
For instance, like if you zoom into M51 in Worldwide Telescope using the Hubble imagery,
yeah,
you're going to see about 4,000 pixels tall.
Okay.
And if you were to look at M51 in their survey, it's about 4 pixels tall.
Okay. Okay.
So the galaxy itself, you can barely make out that it's a little, a spiral galaxy. It's very, very fuzzy, and you can see that there's something there, but you really...
So they didn't they didn't have the Hubble imagery or any other...
No, and even we have the entire sky at 1 arc second per pixel, and probably something like, a couple thousand pixels tall. For like M51, and so it's basically a couple orders of magnitude deeper, which of course every time you go twice the resolution, it's 4 times the data. They could fit everything. They wanted to fit everything onto a CD-ROM, highly compressed.
Right.
And of course, we're talking about terabytes of data. So
right.
It's not something you distribute all the data. So they still have them where you plug everything in the box. You ship it on a CD, you charge $400 for it, and
right.
and people install it one at a time.
Right.
I thought that this should be something that you install a small application, and the data just comes over the network as you need it.
And so is it in fact the case that effectively all of the images and star data is coming to you over the net when you use Worldwide Telescope?
When you use Worldwide Telescope, everything... Everything except the thumbnails are coming over the net.
That's what I figured. Okay.
We used the thumbnails because we wanted we want the word wheel functionality. So when you start typing in an astronomical object and searching for it,
right.
that you that you have the ability to very quickly. See the result set, hundreds of items instantly.
Yeah.
And
yeah, but so that's why the cabinet file is only like 3 megs or something, right? Or whatever it is, it's small.
Yeah. So the full download is with the DirectX install and everything like that. Just under 20 megabytes or
right.
around that range.
Right. But the data file is like 3 megs.
The data file is about 3 megabytes, but that's the catalog information.
Okay.
And the thumbnails themselves are about 12 megabytes, okay, something like that.
Okay.
And there we have 20,000 plus thumbnails in there. But basically, those are designed just to enforce the kind of visual, you know, rapid, quick visual aspect to it. And so, delaying or downloading thumbnails over the network would actually make the response perceived to be a lot slower. And so that's why we went with that decision, as opposed to making the initial download smaller and doing incremental thumbnails. So from this experience of where I kind of like, you know, I have this vision for this product, and it's basically the economics and the driving, you know, technology and stuff like that for it to be done by a commercial software, you know, in the astronomy market, was just not going to happen. And they were also going to be doing something that was aimed entirely at high-end amateur astronomers, not at either professional astronomers or the general public that are the outreach targets from professional astronomers. So basically I still kind of felt there was this unanswered market that we needed to be addressed. So as time went by, eventually Curtis and I got together, and I knew Curtis through a guy who used to work with me, Steve Glenner. He worked with me on Home Advisor, and when he went to work for Curtis, and I used to have lunch with him and often Curtis as well. And I really kind of envied his position in research, being able to really kind of go take a lot of other avenues that weren't immediately commercializable and really kind of explore new things that people hadn't done before. And I thought that was something that I'd originally spent about a year and a half in advanced technology research earlier on when Nathan was running it, and but our what we were doing was almost immediately pulled out into a product unit and then kind of sent out to turn into a commercial product. And so I had been wanting to get back into more of research on making something where you figure out how to solve some new problems, but not just writing a paper and moving on to the next thing. I wanted to be able to take that to where you could create an artifact that would be useful. So Curtis, it turned out, when Steve moved on to another group, I went to him and started pestering him about maybe taking Steve's place. And eventually he worked that out. And after working with some other on some other photo frame projects and things like that, it turned out that Curtis had been exploring this concept of wanting to create a education environment with these rich tools to explore space, and had been collaborating with Jim on SkyServer, and he really wanted to do this, but he was looking for like the technology to make it possible. So here I had this technology, and I'd been looking for someone who was enthusiastic about having a purpose for it. And so here, this is like, you know, the peanut butter and chocolate moment. You know, I don't know if you remember the little Reese's peanut butter commercials, you know. You bump into each other, hey, you got your peanut butter and my chocolate, you know. And so, you know, it's that was like, you know, one of those, wow, how the two people who are like, you know, Curtis passionate from the education side, me from the technology side, and just like having to be in the right company at the right time. And again, Jim facilitated this. I made a demo using some Sloan Digital Sky Survey, and Jim went crazy over it. He was just like, wow, you know, this is the visualization aspect that he'd been looking. You know, Jim was a great database guy. But that's where his skill was at in the database side. And so someone who was skilled in the visualization aspect of it, to bring that database to life in a very visual way, this was like a perfect complement to his concepts that he and Alex were working around about making the data available. And so this is like the front end that makes their, you know, the World Wide Web as a telescope with all this data. This is what makes it consumable by people.
So tell us a little bit about what the back end is and how it is a continuation, or maybe not so much a continuation, of the stuff that Jim had built.
So first of all, we have, you know, Jim's getting people out of these silos of isolated data and actually convince them to put them on the Internet and to create standards of where the data could live where it had a home, and with something called the Virtual Observatory. And he was involved in the National Virtual Observatory and the International Virtual Observatory Alliance, which are the National is the U.S. brand of it, and the IVOA is the international brand of all each country that participates in this, has their own services and organizations and universities and stuff that all participate in this. So now it means that if you know how to talk with these VO standards, you can exchange data, and that you can do queries from other people's data without having to always bring everyone's data in your own house all the time.
So let me just make sure I understand. So on the one hand, these standards enable people to, you know, combine multiple data sets by physically assimilating them. But on the other hand, and this is part of the, you know, as I understand it, the Web Services Federation work that he was interested in. On the other hand, it's possible to federate, as you just said, you know, without actually completely downloading everything. And
right. So it's that you can do with the Virtual Observatory, which is Jim and Alex's, dream of this. This is kind of like Worldwide Telescope. A lot of the astronomers were dealing with data to where data was extracted from catalogs, and so you took image data and then you kind of got the numerical analysis out of the image data and you stuck that in a database.
Yeah.
And so the images themselves were not the transfer of the images wasn't necessarily their domain, its ground of this. They wanted to do the stuff that you could stick in SQL Server.
Right.
And while Terra Server, they stuck image data in SQL Server. The image data was a little more, you know, kind of was actually lagging behind in the sky. But what you could do is you could say, I want to do a query from someplace on the Internet that has some data, and I want to get the data from there. And then I want to take that data and use it as parameters or as, you know, do a join to some other data coming from this other source. And
yeah,
so you could essentially combine, you know, these web services to, get data from a variety of different sources. And sometimes it required that the data marshal over from one machine to another to, you know, for processing efficiencies. But essentially it meant that you didn't have to locate and translate everything into your own database in order to make this possible.
Yeah, but I assume that's not happening on the back end of Worldwide Telescope. We aren't waiting for calls to go across the network to bring in, you know, this or that data set, right? So
right.
You've obviously combined those for your purposes.
So what we've done in Worldwide Telescope is that there are a common sets of data that you're going to need all the time, and there's a relatively small amount of data that you basically will need, perpetually need. And what we do is we download that to your client. So we give you the client application, but we also give you, some thumbnails and some catalog data and some, you know, basically, stuff that you're going to ask for so often, we might as well just make it live, you know, live on your client.
So, for example, what's in the catalog?
So, for instance, the Messier objects, the NGC
okay.
objects,
okay.
The list of your solar system objects,
okay.
Thumbnails for all of those things.
And coordinates for those things.
Yeah, the coordinates for them, things
okay.
like, you know, their magnitudes and their classifications and things like that. So,
okay.
So that sort of information that's pretty much you're going to want to, most of the 10,000 brightest stars.
Okay, so we're talking about a catalog of like 10K objects or something
We're actually, it was probably around 30K or something.
Okay.
Like that, 30,000 objects or whatever. And we're going to basically make that live on your machine because almost everyone's going to download these in order to be able to zip around in the sky and look at stuff and say, hey, what's that?
And so far, in that respect, it's comparable to Starry Night or what another program is doing.
Right, and that's generally where those planetariums stop. They go a little bit beyond by having a little bit bigger download.
Okay.
But basically, they instead of like, we do this all in 20 meg, they may have 200 or 300 meg or, mm-hmm. A gigabyte or something that they download.
Mm-hmm.
But basically, what you get, what they download, is all you're ever going to get either.
Right. Right.
And so so we started out by basically saying, okay, well, let's take a reasonably manageable set of stuff. We'll make it live there. And then what we say is, okay, here's all the imagery. We're going to basically, when you start up, you're going to contact the Worldwide Telescope, and we're going to give you metadata about what's available. And that metadata is going to say, hey, so you want to look at a Hubble collection, Spitzer collection, and then that metadata tells you where you need to go get this stuff from.
Okay.
Now, some of it we will host in Microsoft's data center for scale reasons.
Mm-hmm.
And to ensure that it's available because it's going to be so popular, we don't want to have, a university server go down and not be redundant or something and find out that, a lot of our clients are upset. But then the limit isn't that. This data can be anywhere. It can be at Space Telescope. It can be at, JPL.
So what is the actual case then? Like right now I'm looking at the list of sources, right? So the Digital Sky Survey, I assume you host, right?
Right. So we are hosting a significant portion of the data we launched with because slightly political reason, which is we don't have a Space Act agreement with NASA yet, so we really can't enter into anything most informal handshake type operations. Even though we've actually collaborated with a lot of people who are NASA-funded, they're not allowed to acknowledge that collaboration or put anything in a legal document or anything like that until we have this Space Act agreement done. So to a certain extent, there are some people that we could have just pointed the data to, but if we did that, it would be in violation of some sort of internal NASA policies or whatever.
Okay.
And so we've chosen that we've hosted a little bit more than we probably could have done for our initial release, but the concept is that you can also plug in data from other sources through communities that we're not even aware of. You just load it from your you load the references to it in your client, the metadata in your client,
and
you can do this by going to a website for that community or for that organization and loading in this metadata, and then you basically have access to terabytes of their data.
Mm-hmm.
And the other aspect of this is that we have.
Can I just jump in and ask about that? So, in addition to there being standards about how any of these sources represents an object and its coordinates and other metadata around it, it seems like there would need to be a standard about how you query a source like that, since they're all going to be huge, right? So, like, is that part of it as well? Is there a protocol for, a standard protocol for querying these sources?
So, when I was saying about how images were kind of lagging behind.
Yeah.
We understand, Worldwide Telescope, we have the ability, we understand what they call O tables. And, so if we go and we query a database, there are standard ways of creating a query and there's standard ways of getting results back out of it. And so the internally, the client knows how to, when it's looking at for certain databases, it knows how to interpret them. And so two ways we can do it, one of which is our servers can go off and do the queries, and then they can consolidate or represent the data in a cache on our servers with high capacity scaling and redundancy.
Mm-hmm.
And then we can basically regurgitate the data as necessary to our clients.
Mm-hmm.
And so, for instance, when Hubble, we do a query VO SIA, or Simple Image Access, a protocol query to Hubble Space Telescope occasionally. And when they have new images that are available that have been processed, then we download these 500 megabyte, 1 gigabyte images from them that have been mosaics of a huge number of Hubble exposures.
Mm-hmm.
That would be a very big download for a client. And then we chop them up into pieces and create a tiled multi-resolution pyramid out of them and then store them on our server.
Okay.
And so in a sense, the raw consumer wouldn't have been able to make very much use of this.
Yeah.
But because we were able to put our value added into that pipeline, Hubble took the image, Space Telescope processed it, they put it up on a web service, we processed, do another step of processing to make it visualization friendly. And then now we can have lots of people come in, they can see a thumbnail of it, they can click on it, it zooms in, and the instant that they click on that thumbnail and the client zooms in on it, they're already seeing the image.
Mm-hmm.
And as they zoom in to a part of the image, they're able to look at all the gorgeous detail of it. But they don't have to download every single pixel of the image like they would have to in order to view it if they
sure.
were going to the original source.
Now, in the case of, let's say, like, you know, we were talking about Andromeda, right? And
right.
I think you mentioned that feature is going to be like 4,000 pixels high when you zoom in.
Okay, actually, it was M51,
okay,
right?
M51,
that we
right.
were talking about, yeah.
I don't know the name of that
Whirlpool
one.
Galaxy.
Okay, Whirlpool, yeah. So that's
right.
like a 4,000 pixel high
or
image.
It's actually 16,000.
16,000.
Yeah.
Okay. But that's not 400 megabytes worth of stuff, is it?
It's the Whirlpool Galaxy, I think, is about 500 megabytes.
Really? Okay. Okay.
I think the M101 is about like 700 megabytes or something as the full resolution TIFF file.
Okay. Okay.
And I think that the object, you know, the portion of the object that I was comparing like the central spiral portion or whatever.
Okay.
I may have actually been off by a factor of two when I said 4,000.
Okay.
I think the image is something like 16,000 by 24,000
okay.
or something like that. We have a M42 image that is so big that a traditional PC, you have to have a 64-bit operating system in order to even load the image.
Okay. Now, is this engine related to the deep zoom technology, or what's the story there?
We predate the deep zoom technology. It has some similarities. The difference is that the deep zoom and Sea Dragon and stuff like that are 2D technologies.
Right.
That use the graphics engine for doing tiled multi-resolution images. We actually have to align all of our images in three-dimensional space because essentially from the Earth, the space looks like a big sphere at almost infinite distance.
Mm-hmm.
But there is a curvature to it.
Mm-hmm.
And if you go around, if imagine like taking a round room and trying to put a bunch of bathroom tiles on it, right, and then
mm-hmm.
grout it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the tiles seem to come together and have parallel lines for a while, but eventually what happens is, you know, they start not working very well.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? Maybe you can take one line of tiles all the way around, you know, the equator of this sphere, but as you go up, you're going to have fewer and fewer tiles, and eventually get to a point where you have a weird shaped tile and, you know, fewer of them at each row and the lines no longer line up. And so that's part of the problem that we have is we're looking at a spherical data. And so we had to come up with a a new spherical transform that preserved the poles. In previous projects like Virtual Earth or Terra Server or Google Earth, the poles were not really an important part of the data because no one learned and no one needed map directions to it. Right?
Yeah.
So essentially, you know, as far as the Earth is concerned, the primary commercial interest, you can cut off everything above a certain latitude, and no one would ever notice.
That's so funny.
But you can't treat the sky that way, and you can't treat the moon or other planets that way either.
Yeah.
So when you have something like Google Sky, where they tried to put in, a sky view and use essentially the same mapping, the poles are impossible to look at. There's just garbage there.
Yeah.
And so there's, you know, that's the, we had to come up with something called TOAST that would, with the tessellated octahedral adaptive subdivision transform, is what TOAST stands for. And what that does is basically it creates a 360-degree wraparound a view that's either a planet surface or this infinite sphere of the sky. And it lets you represent it using a 3D graphics accelerator very rapidly and very efficiently. And so we can have an image pyramid similar to the way that, you know, Deep Zoom and other technologies work.
Mm-hmm.
And Terra Server, you know, before it worked, but we don't have to. We don't have to give up the poles.
That's fascinating.
So part of that is that was something that didn't exist. There were things like Mercator projection, which is how you're used to seeing a Earth map on a flat piece of paper.
Right.
You know, how do you take a round Earth and print it on a flat piece of paper?
Right.
It's a very difficult thing. So you have to do some weird mathematics on it to make it work at all. Then there's, you know, equirectangular projection, but essentially there was nothing that could deal with storing an image in a spherical projection. There was one thing called HeelPix, but it was so slow to process that it couldn't have ever been used for visualizing data.
Okay.
Maybe another 20 or 30 years of Moore's Law, we could do it, but,
okay.
You know.
So can you then kind of fill me in on, the basic experience here is, you know, you look up in the sky like, okay, I recognize that constellation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you find the constellation in the World Wide Telescope. You start zooming in, and then the sort of what I am thinking of is the contextual awareness system alerts you by presenting these thumbnails of, oh, there are these objects in the neighborhood. Oh, there's this galaxy, right? And you say, yeah, let me see
right.
that. Then you kind of zoom in and you kind of switch over to another data source, right? So you might have been using one of these like all sky surveys, you know, when you get to the, you know, to the object which has, you know, the more detailed image behind it, you switch to that mode. So I'm kind of thinking of it as a, on one level, as a combination of all sky surveys and then selected, you know, high-res images for
studies,
different sources,
yeah,
right?
What we call studies.
Yeah, but there are like multiple all-sky surveys available
right.
too, right? That you can switch between. So, you know, and it's actually, I mean, you know, it's quite an amazing thing, you know, to be kind of switching over into the infrared, for example, to look at the Milky Way, and all of a sudden it's this incandescent band. You know, it's really
right.
It's really quite dramatic,
right?
It
used to be darkness in the visual bands that we look at.
Yeah.
It's actually glowing in the infrared.
Yeah.
In a really long wavelength.
Yeah. And now you were able to weave all that stuff together in a coherent way because of this work that was done for the Virtual Observatory. So it is the case that these data sets...
Well, actually, the no.
No, okay.
So this is where TOAST came in.
Okay.
So what astronomers did before is that because there was no way of visualizing the full data, they would store all their images as a bunch of individual... Okay, so if you have a sphere in the sky, right?
Right.
You put a camera and you take a picture. What shows up on the film is what's called a tangential projection. And what it is it's the tangent plane. The film is a flat piece, and so it's basically, it's like taking a imagine taking a beach ball with all the stars plotted on them, right?
Right.
And then putting a light right in the middle of it, and then putting that right up against the wall where one point of the beach ball touches the wall.
Mm-hmm.
And then what will happen is the beach ball itself is dark everywhere except the stars. And then the stars will basically shine out, shine out through the little, light holes and eventually hit that wall mm-hmm. and light up someplace on that wall. So mm-hmm. all of these beams are coming from the very, projecting out from the middle of that sphere and then where they lie on the sphere surface, and then they come all the way out to where they hit on the wall. And so what that's doing is it's a way of taking something round and displaying it on something flat.
Mm-hmm.
And as long as you're looking at a very small part of the sky, there isn't very much distortion.
Right.
But when you start looking at a very large part of the sky,
the distortion
becomes huge. When you look at all of it, well, it's impossible. Because
even if you're looking at all of it with a conglomeration of very small tiles,
even with a bunch of small tiles, right? If you're looking at it from one projection, the projection can only see like about 90 degrees or so, and before you basically get this, for tangent projection, right? You can only see so much of it before you get this fisheye view, and then it no longer is a tangent projection; it becomes something else.
Okay. So to map this onto your sphere was necessary to correct for that distortion.
That's correct. And so what we have to do is when we go back to that illustration of trying to put bathroom tiles all over the inside of a round spherical building, right? We have the same problem here. Now, astronomers, what they did is they put these things into these databases as a bunch of tangential projections,
mm-hmm.
and they even knew how to mosaic them together to make, bigger chunks of it. But essentially, when it came to anything larger than that, everything kind of broke down, and they really didn't have much of a solution for
it. Okay, so they could make small mosaics, but they couldn't make really big ones.
If they made really big ones, they had to use projections that couldn't represent the poles properly, and everything would get further and further distorted the further it got from the equator.
Okay.
So now we have services like, for instance, NASA SkyView. And NASA had over 50 full sky surveys sitting inside these servers. And while the NASA SkyView, they participate in the virtual observatory, the images themselves are not actually stored in VO compliant, in internationally, they're a private standard for how to get data in and out of them, rather than a they're a private, well documented standard rather than a internationally accepted, standard.
Okay.
But they did have over 50 full sky surveys, and so what we did was we gave them code for TOAST, and we showed them how that rather than when people, instead of asking for a specific part of the sky, what they used to do is they would put together the parts of the mosaic together from several different images of the sky, and they would find out where those images overlapped, and then they would give you one image that had parts from lots of different images.
Mm-hmm.
So if you asked for a wider area, you could get either a piece of a single image if it was a real small area, or a wide area, you'd get several images put together in a mosaic.
Mm-hmm.
But now we basically said we could ask for just a single tile at a given level of resolution. So we could ask for one tile that was the entire sky, or we could ask for a little tiny piece of the whole sky that was just one little a part of that sky, but everything was laid out in a very specific grid for our projection. And so that standard allowed, while their software couldn't do it very quickly, it allowed us to go through and get all the tiles from their server for all these different studies and then put them up on our high-capacity servers.
Mm-hmm.
And so essentially, there is an automated path to go from a bunch of individual pictures of the sky to this full sky mosaic that can be seen as the seamless data. And once you've figured out how to do that pipeline, that can be repeated over and over and over.
Well, so where in that pipeline, data. Where is the TOAST transform being applied?
So right now, the TOAST transform is being applied, like for that particular data, on the NASA servers.
Oh, so you gave them the algorithm, and they're running it for you.
That's correct. And eventually, they'll be able to host the data when they have the capacity. They'll be able to host the data directly off of their servers.
Okay.
And so you could just point a Worldwide Telescope client there. And even today, you theoretically could point a Worldwide Telescope client at that NASA server.
Interesting.
And have it give you any data set that they had available there.
They keep the sources as they acquired them, but then they have also got the output of this transform available to queries.
Well, what they do is they actually generate the transform on the fly for each query. And what we do is we just cache that output. They could add a cache and then warm the cache.
Okay.
And then it would be acceptable for interactive preview.
So you said there's like 50 of these. So when you look in...
More than 50.
When you look in... those are all the weirdly named ones that you look in Worldwide Telescope and see kind of at the bottom of the list, like just all these kind of abstruse sources that are listed. That's what those are?
Yeah. So, for instance, when you hear like ROSAT and WMAP and things like that.
Okay.
Those are the full sky surveys. So one of the things we've done is, for the first time ever, we've assembled a view of the sky where you can look at everything from microwave all the way to gamma.
Yeah.
Microwave is the radio waves. So all the way from the longest wavelength, lowest energy of the electromagnetic spectrum, all the way to super high energetic particles.
It's completely amazing, and it's just you know, wild to be able to, as you've set it up, you know, kind of crossfade between these different things and compare, you know, like, okay, this is what you see, this is what the two mass is seeing, and this is what, you know, it's pretty amazing.
Yeah. So the idea here is that we put together a standard for how you can visualize a spherical data set. We've given the people the ability to create this data, and we've provided a client that knows how to accept this astronomy data, both the spherical data and the original tangential images. So when you have a study, like from Hubble, they can use the original tangential images the way they came off the camera, and it can be shown in Worldwide Telescope. And we figure out the math and the 3D transform so that when we align that to the TOAST background from another full sky survey, that all the stars are exactly where they should be and everything lines up.
Wow.
And because we have this universal coordinate system called right ascension and declination, that we can align all of these images up so that things are in the right place on the sky. And when you crossfade between it, you're looking at you're maybe looking at apples and oranges, but you're looking at them
in the same place
on the same tree.
That's a great explanation. Now, is this going to be a public standard? And you know, will there be the possibility of other clients, you know, hitting your services or other services that support these standards?
We've offered to certainly we've offered the algorithms and the code to other organizations. People doing, other astronomy, you know, JPL, and we've even told Google that if they're interested in reworking their All Sky surveys to be able to use this format, that's something that we would work with them on.
Wow.
So far, they don't have the development resources to do that. They've got such a critical mass on their current projects that they really don't think that they can take that on anytime soon.
But so the point here is that there's been some pushback, as you know, about, oh, this looks like it's a Windows only product, and I mean the client is Windows only,
yeah.
but there's a lot here that is potentially of much broader use and availability. So
yeah, certainly, and part of it is all of the data that we support in Worldwide Telescope, and the language we use called WTML, which is the way of describing. So when people ask me, they say, well, how is Worldwide Telescope different than like an astronomy package like the Sky or Starry Night?
Mm-hmm.
And I say this is Worldwide Telescope is like a browser. It's like Internet Explorer is to the web, or
right.
Safari or Netscape or whatever, Firefox is to the web. It's a browser to browse data. Now the data itself is stored in these formats that are astronomy friendly, and VO catalogs and WTML, which is Worldwide Telescope markup language, and it's basically it's an XML format that describes where the image data comes from, what the properties of these catalogs are,
mm-hmm.
Where queries can be made to,
mm-hmm.
And the Worldwide Telescope is a browser for that. So WTML is like HTML, and Worldwide Telescope is like Internet Explorer or Safari or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And so just
now WTML is just to be clear, WTML is not the XML syntax that you see when you make a tour and then open up that file, right? That's a different thing.
Okay, when you open up a tour, if you save a WTT tour, the XML itself, if you load it into Notepad, you can kind of sneak a peek at the XML.
Yeah, I've done that, yeah.
And that's we're not even documenting that part.
Okay.
That's the tour XML format.
Yeah, that's something else.
And
okay.
That's something else entirely.
Yep.
But if you look in your user folder and you start looking at the XML for, like, image sets, and if you look at, like, the XML, if you join a community, and you look at the XML for the community, or you look at the WTML cache for the once you've loaded communities, you'll start seeing this. Or if you add objects to your to my collections, to your WWT collections,
right.
And then you open your documents folder, and then you'll see a WWT collections folder underneath that,
okay.
And you'll see WTML there. That's what it's about,
okay.
And it basically describes folders. For hierarchies, it can describe network links to other folders. It can describe objects. It can describe images. It can give a synopsis or metadata to a tour. So, for instance, a tour in WTML is kind of a like an index or a metadata about the tour. It isn't the tour,
right.
But what it is it's saying, this is the tour, this is its name, how many stars it has, what it's related to, its categories, and this is where you can download the binary to run that tour. We can also have things in WTML, for instance, saying, like, there is a article in Sky and Telescope magazine about Messier 51,
mm-hmm.
And so it has the location in the sky of that object, and when you join a community, the Sky and Telescope community, and you load the community in, and then you happen to be browsing around, and M51 shows up in view, and you look down in the context search, you now have an article that you can click on, and it will pop up that article.
Yeah.
And so that gives you the ability to have this location-sensitive object where it's like it's basically just an HTTP link with spatial location information,
mm-hmm.
And that basically lets you see things in the context.
That's dependent on which communities I belong to as to which context appears.
That's correct.
Okay.
Not only which communities that you belong to, but basically we show you the Worldwide Telescope stuff that's kind of global. And then we show you this when you log into a community. We show you the union of the currently the community you're currently looking at, and the World Wide Telescope information.
Okay.
So in the future, we might make it so that you could filter out to just showing you the community information.
Okay.
But right now, it just shows you it shows you WWT stuff and then your community stuff.
Okay.
So if you were joined to three or four communities, you would only see the one that you were currently drilled into at that point.
Okay. All right. So I'm starting to get the picture here. This is extremely helpful. Now let me kind of unwind your whole discussion about the projection and see if this does or doesn't relate to something I noticed last night, actually, when I was sitting on the porch looking up at the sky and had the application open. And so basically, you know, I found the Milky Way and I was trying to basically go west from there, you know, pan west, right? And it seemed like things wanted to not pan west and east or left and right. It seemed like things wanted to spin when I was moving around. Do you know what I mean?
So if you were in, there's two ways of looking at the sky, one of which is looking at the full spherical, everything, like if the Earth didn't exist and you were sitting someplace on Earth and looking out at the universe with Earth not being there, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you're Earth-centered, but the horizon or ground isn't blocking your view.
Mm-hmm.
And north is up, south is down, and unless you specifically spin your view, then essentially when you move, north will always stay north,
mm-hmm.
and south will always stay down.
Yeah. You know, so that's the view without the horizon, down. Basically.
That's the view without the horizon.
Right.
With the horizon, the zenith always stays looking up, and as you move around, if you're looking at the zenith will always stay at the top. So you can make the view, the zenith can never go below halfway down, halfway through the screen.
Uh-huh.
Right, so you can't force the zenith to be below the midpoint of the screen.
Okay.
And part of it, the reason we've done this, for people keeping their context of what's up, one of the things they found is with like a space station where there is no up or down, you would think that you could be free to design anything you wanted to and people could just float around in three-dimensional space and they're not, there is no up, there is no down, there will be no preferred direction. But the reality is humans get extremely confused
yep.
because left and right, when they flip and everything like that, your brain actually has a natural desire to want to have an up and a down and a left and a right.
Mm-hmm.
And when you invert them, you don't process things.
Mm-hmm.
And so what ends up happening is in space, they like paint different colors or whatever, you end up picking a direction of where you normally put your feet. And while you might flip around, when you start navigating, you orient yourself to a place where you know what's up and down. And even if you're navigating upside down, you always say, that's up, and this is left, even though it's right to me. You know, you kind of invert it. So what was happening, if you were on the view from here, the zenith would always stay up. If
okay.
you were on the other mode, where you were just looking at the full universe, the north should always stay up. And if you went to the North Pole and you tried to move beyond the North Pole, you would only be able to spin.
Okay.
Because you would not be able to pull the North Pole any further than the middle, the middle of the screen, right? Because
okay.
that's your viewpoint.
Okay.
And so what would happen otherwise is basically south would then start becoming up and left would be right and, you'd be spinning in the hamster ball, right?
Okay. So if I want to, just subjectively, right? If I sit and I look up and it's like, okay, there's the Milky Way, and then I want to kind of swing to the left as I am observing the sky and locate, let's say, the Pleiades, right?
Right.
So if in the program,
if you want to simulate looking at the sky, then you want to turn on, you want to go to view, and then you want to select location where you're at, the city, you know, state, country, city, state, and then you want to say view from here, and then you will it will show you what you can't see as being the ground, and you'll see a horizon, and then you'll see north, south, east, and west around the compass point, and then straight up will be north. And at that point, what will happen is it will simulate your eyes, right? You can look at the horizon. If you're standing up, you can look at the horizon, and then you can start looking up, up, up in the sky. And then what happens? When you're looking straight up, your neck is tilted all the way back to where it's touching your back, and you can't tilt anymore.
Right.
And to see any further back, you would have to fall over. Okay? So then what do? You tilt up until you can see, and then what you do is you rotate yourself around to see and go down looking south.
Right.
And that's how your head works, and that's how a telescope with an alt-az mount works.
Right.
And so that's what we simulate in the view there. You can look up, but you can't tilt your head so far back like the penguins and the apocryphal thing about that they look up at the airplane, it goes over their heads, and they fall over back.
So in that mode, panning left is looking left.
That's correct.
Okay. All right.
And left will be, you know, north for a while, and then it'll be south, you know, east and west or whatever. You know, as you start moving, if you're at the horizon, you'll see that. So we're trying to simulate those two modes, and we're trying to put constraints on there so that people really don't get lost and upside down and backwards. But unfortunately, sometimes it's hard for people to, you know, explain, well, what happens when I get to the poles? You know, and if you just think of it of like, I'm looking up, okay, my head is now stuck into my back. I can't look up any further without falling over, bending over backwards. You know. So I guess if you lay down on the ground on a towel, you know, or something, you could tilt your head back maybe further. But
Well, I'm going to have to actually go back and look at that again because I don't remember exactly. Well, what do you think most people expect to do?
I think that we've tried to model based upon people looking up at the sky.
Yeah.
For the view from the sky. The other aspect, when you're totally unconstrained and north is north, there is a common a convention in astronomy to always put north up. And there is what they call, with right ascension and declination, and what they call the equatorial, you know, an equatorial mount, or, you know, an equatorial view of things, that you have the poles and things rotate around the poles. So, for instance, this whole sky rotates around the poles. And so, therefore, your left and right are sort of rotating through the poles, and then your up and down becomes looking up towards the north or down to the south. And so that's your way of kind of navigating in that sphere spinning around you. You know, I think that it's a little harder to... I think the alt-az mode, or the, you know, the view from here mode... is pretty much naturally viewed based upon human physiology, right?
Yeah.
If you were to, like, look at the Milky Way, you would be tilting your head up and down while you'd be rotating your body to follow it across the horizon.
Right.
And it's pretty natural for you to do it when you're pointing your head and moving your body, you know, to do it all together. But what's actually going to happen is the view is going to rotate as you do that. Right, the view of the sky, if you were to take a camera and point it and then take a whole series of pictures and look at them, the view of the camera would actually rotate, you know, the orientation of where things would be would rotate as you rotate your body and tilt your head. So,
yep.
It's as analogous to the real world, you know, aspects of looking out and stargazing, you know, as we can get it. There, I don't think there's anyone in the world who can actually operate the way like the Google Sky model is, where it doesn't constrain any direction or.
But you provide that as well.
Like that. What's that?
You provide that as well, right?
We do not. We cannot simulate the Google style total unconstrained view. The only thing we do allow is once you're viewing something, you can rotate the camera position by hitting control and then dragging left and right. And that will rotate the camera's view.
It's a control drag.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right. It's possible that you could have gotten yourself control dragged in, and we have a view reset camera if you want.
Ah.
That takes you back to neutral.
Okay.
And we don't preserve the camera rotation between it. But when people are creating tours and they want to make the view rotate so that you kind of zoom in a spiral on something, or
you want
to orientate, like M51 goes up and down, but your screen goes left and right. If you want to zoom in and have it and frame it, you need to rotate your camera like you would a real camera.
Okay.
To frame it better.
And so clicking control while you drag is going to do that.
Holding control down and dragging left and right will spin the whole view around the point that you're currently looking at.
All right. Okay. I think that may have been the confusion. Okay.
Yeah. Unfortunately, there's communicating. What we do when you get in that mode is then we try to north, south, east, and west make sense based on that. But it will do some strange things on the poles because we still try to keep north minus your rotation up.
Okay.
Right? So if you rotate 90 degrees and you try to say east, well, the North Pole is always going to try to stay to your east.
Right.
You know, so
right.
it is that mode is a little bit strange.
So in general, the reason to...
The only reason we give that feature, we give that feature people making tours so they can frame things better and stuff.
Yeah.
But it's not something that we try to document or recommend people using for normal browsing.
Okay. So in the normal case, you have the choice of view from here or not, right? You have the case of...
Or just kind of view from an equirectangular. It's sort of like, you know, everything... if you want to deal... If you care about your position on Earth, right, you view from here.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to pretend you're like at universal coordinates,
mm-hmm.
right, and you want to basically ignore your position on Earth,
mm-hmm.
then you use the default mode, which is we really don't care where you're at. We're just going to show you the whole sky, without a constraint of your horizon or what you could or couldn't really see if at that date and time at
mm-hmm.
that location.
Yeah.
So date and time and time of year and season and where you are on Earth are completely ignored when you're in that mode. It's just this is the sky, immutable, unmoving.
And I forget that.
Move around on it, but.
But that is the default then?
Yeah, that's the default mode when you open it up.
You do everything. Okay.
Because partly when we start up, we don't know your location.
Right.
So you have to enter that in, and then once you've entered it in. And you click view from here, then you know you're basically saying I want to look at things from the horizon. But one of the cool things about Worldwide Telescope is it lets you see this, you know, what the sky would be like from anywhere.
Right.
And it lets you see a lot of objects that you know, and stars and constellations that you'd never be able to see without actually flying, you know, across the world.
Right.
And so that I think, you know, pretty much opens up the entirety of the universe and not just what you can see from your spot on Earth.
Yeah, if it wasn't cloudy.
Yeah, if it wasn't cloudy.
Okay, well, we'll never get to the bottom of this, and there's a ton here, but I think that there's definitely a lot of good stuff here that helps me and I think will help other people to get at what I was really looking for here, which is, you know, what's actually been accomplished here, right? You know, in terms of taking, you know, this raw astronomy data and correlating it, you know, in a way that is then, you know, not just consumable in the sense of, you know, quantities of data and transmission over the network, but in terms of sense making, right? And understanding the relationships among things and and understanding. Well,
and then, of course, you know, the tours, you know, and part of it is that for the vision of getting everybody access to all this astronomy data required systematic changes at every single level, right? We built on some things that Jim, you know, had pioneered with NVO and stuff and worked from there. But essentially, it was very systematic. It had to be how people process the data, how the, you know, the client to access the data, the protocols over the wire, the educating people once they've done it, providing a context for it. So we put a lot of things together, but we also created this whole systematic model of how to do everything from end to end, top to bottom, left to right, in order to make a model. Now, there may be other people who use the different pieces that we've created and change different parts of them to, you know, put different data sources, different visualizations of it, different, you know, say someone creates a Macintosh or a Mac OS-based client or an iPhone client that uses Worldwide Telescope data, you know, that's possible, or, you know, a mobile phone version of it or a web-based version of it or something. So, you know, over time, us or other people could replace various components, but as a reference model, being able to really address all of everything to make, you know, a systematic approach to solving all the problems of getting, you know, the data into people's homes and into their eyeballs is you know, really, you know, that you had to solve for all of those problems, or otherwise, you know, it still made it, you know, it still blocked people from really being able to explore.
Will this be kind of published in terms of, you know, the whole, like you said, the whole end-to-end pipeline?
Well, part of the process of over the next several months is there are the points of things like TOAST and WTML and our communities interface are going to be documented. There are already some documentation out, and there will be documentation, code, tools, and things like that that will be coming out over the next few weeks to, you know, over the summer to help people understand more about this.
Mm-hmm.
There are some of the protocols we will, you know, as time goes by, we need to, you know, do some work to make sure that they're ready for us to recommend the standards.
Okay, excellent. I really appreciate your time.
Okay, thank you very much.